In North America and Europe, somehow people who make the most money wins. That's a money game we're all kind of like forced to be in. But what if the game is how happy I can become? So if you put that category, are you winning the game?
Welcome to the Jason Mark Campbell Business Podcast, where we explore what it really takes to sell, lead, and grow a business, and ultimately, live well. In every episode, we go beyond tactics to discover how entrepreneurs and leaders across different sectors are growing with love, impact, and integrity. Ladies and gentlemen, welcome back to the Jason Mark Campbell Podcast. I'm so excited that I have one of my favorite guests to bring on the show. Matter of fact, I believe is the returning guest with the highest frequency on the podcast because he has always been here sharing wisdom around wealth, around money, around rewriting some of our beliefs, as well as our relationship with such aspects that are so important to our life. And now that we've discussed enough about money, I want to go into a topic that goes a little beyond, that allows us to be more aligned with how do we live a life that's of purpose, that's contributing, that's really making a dent in the world and the universe. And Ken Honda is the guest that's joining me. If you're not familiar with Ken, the man is the author of the book Happy Money, as well as True Wealth, has written several books in multiple languages, and truly has been inspiring a generation to rewrite the rules on how they have success, purpose, and all the good things in life. And I'm so excited that he's going to be joining me again on the podcast to share some more. Ken, welcome back.
Hi, Jason. Again and again, I hope you guys will not start like, oh, Ken Honda again, you know.
I was just about to say the same thing. I hope you're not thinking, oh my God, Jason's here asking me the same questions again. But we always go into different topics, right?
Yes. I mean, you are so incredible. You know, for those of you, you know, I've been interviewed by so many people. But this person, you know, this guy, Jason Campbell, asked one of the best questions that go very deep inside. And you not only ask me questions, but also put me into thinking, you know, deep thinking about how I can contribute to the world more. So you're not only a great interviewer, but you're such a great inspiration for me. So when you say you'll come back, you know, I'll be back before you know it.
You know, you put me in a self-doubt position where I'm like, well, I always bring you back because I know how much you contribute to the entire list of listeners. But I'm like, am I being selfish? Because I just love the praise and admiration you give and the compliments you give. That just gets me so excited. So a little selfish, but a lot of positive ripples. How about that?
Yes. And also for those people who are listening to us, because you enjoy it, I enjoy it. So like this vibration of like both of us kind of enjoying each other must be also a great addition on top of what we share. So
this is true. Well, honestly, it's a great segue into the topic because, you know, we had a chance to meet in Amsterdam. We were both at Mindvalley University. We went out for a lovely lunch. I have a beautiful gift that's in my bag, a pen that Ken gave me, which is a very generous gift as well. And we got together and we realized there's a concept that we should speak more about, which is the Ikigai concept. It's something you've spoken about extensively, particularly in the Japanese market, and I know you're sharing this message with the English market as well. And I find that, you know, the fact that I get to do these interviews, connect with you, I feel like this is a concept that I'm flirting with and I get a chance to play. And I think it's a tool that for anybody who isn't aware is going to get to discover today. I'm so excited about. So I'd be curious about your origins with Ikigai. Is this something you've known from a young age and how did it come into your life?
Yes, thanks for asking. Another great question. So when I was in my 20s, I started my quest for the truth, how to find the meaning of life. And there's this Japanese word called Ikigai. By now, since the book Ikigai sold so many copies, you may have heard of this word. But the concept literally means it's a life worth living. So that is a concept I've been looking for. So I bump into a mentor who is a multi-billionaire. But at the same time, he was very lonely. I was the only one he could talk to. So his Ikigai is for money, but is it like good enough? And then I bump into another mentor who doesn't have any money, but who is so happy with people, neighbors, and you know, he's an artist. So without money, as long as you have Ikigai and people, you're all set. Because Ikigai will bring you joy. Your friends can bring you money and food. So as long as you have Ikigai, you are 95% happy. And on top of that, there are two kinds of Ikigai. One that brings you only joy, and the other brings joy with money. That is what I'm going to talk about today.
So then that might bring me to ask about the misconceptions about Ikigai, because this is the first time that I hear about two different Ikigais. I always thought it was one concept, so I might have to ask you to elaborate.
Yeah, so, you know, even though it's your life purpose, Ikigai has a meaning of simply brings joy to your life. So it could be your very selfish Ikigai, like collecting like Superman figures or Star Wars collection of that. That kind of thing just brings you joy. That's it. So that could be your Ikigai too, because that brings you joy. But there are a different kind of Ikigai that brings you joy and at the same time bring other people joy. So for us, just sharing like this brings us joy. Not only brings us joy, but we give some value. Like writing is my Ikigai. So at the end of every day, I wonder how many people have I brought some smile to. So usually my books are sold about 1,000 to 2,000 copies every day in the world somewhere. So that means that I bring a smile to so many people. That is my Ikigai. And the other Ikigai is just having a chat with stuff like this. No, these little cute ones. Like cute, kawaii stuff is my Ikigai. So I have a collection of these cute ones. It's kind of like staring at me, like cheering me up.
I have to first interrupt you, Ken, and just say for those who are listening only, Ken brought onto the screen a very cute figurine of some neko, a little cat. And so your collectible of figurines.
Yeah, so this brings me joy, but doesn't bring me money, you know. And some people may want to buy it, I don't sell it. So, you know, just purely brings me joy, right? No, so there must be something that brings you only joy, like watching YouTube videos and other thing, it brings you only joy. But you have to sort of like elevate your Ikigai so it could benefit others. And you need to kind of have little skills. That's what I teach. So bringing your Ikigai into your life vision, life work, so you can monetize it too. That is a little tricky because you need some skills to do that.
Ken, I'm glad you brought the Ikigai joy part and even about, you know, having, you know, your figurines, your cats, it's like your little guilty pleasure, you could say, or the thing that's just for you. And, you know, I have activities like I love playing video games. And to me, that's probably in this concept an Ikigai that I get to connect with friends, play some games, develop some stories, experience artistry in the same time and just a fun time, you know. But I have a lot of guilt around allowing myself to experience that joy. And does that mean I might have an unhealthy relationship with my Ikigai?
No. So the reason why I'm just teaching people Ikigai is I want to free all of you from feeling the guilt for only pleasure, you know? So I have to be careful with my English because a lot of people think I'm talking about some sexual fantasy. I'm not. My English is getting better, but I just say something so outrageous in English context, which I have no intention. So when I talk about pleasure, people start giggling. You know, I don't know what you're smiling or laughing at, but that's not something, you know, I'm talking about. So there's always some guilt around pleasure. So simple joy is like gardening, collecting things, and wasting your time in the video games. No, you're not wasting your time. You're just making your soul smile. That brings you more joy. So the day after, you can work for somebody else. And so if you have that Ikigai in you that nourishes your soul, nourishes your body, nourishes your, you know, mental health, then that is worth doing it. So it's, you're not wasting your time. So I want to free you from funny guilt.
And then another question that comes around this is that I've often seen advice saying, like, when you find the thing you enjoy, you should try to see if you can make money with that thing so that it combines. Is that a prescription you also speak about, or do you think those are two completely different things?
Yes and no. Some people can do that. Other people cannot. You test it if you have a gift or not. I have a friend who loves singing, but when he asked his friends to do karaoke with him, a lot of people smile and said, oh, I have something, you know, tonight. So, well, I have a meeting tonight. So nobody wants to go to karaoke with him because he's a lousy singer. But he wants to shout. He wants to dance. He's a fun guy. So when I'm probably super drunk, I can be with him. But Otherwise, I have to cover my ears. You know, those people who love singing, but terrible. So those people cannot become a professional singer. You know, it's a common sense. So those of you who love baseball, who love watching football or just soccer, you know, you cannot be a professional soccer or basketball player. It just brings you joy. So don't think about just doing anything monetizing because you are going to be disappointed. So you should really figure out, do you think it would be even possible to bring money? If not, just save it for fun. Otherwise, you're going to struggle in a very hard way. So there are some teachers who say, you can make your joy into money. Oh, you know, no. I mean, it could work, but only 10% people, 90% people, you should keep it as a hobby. And then if you want to be a singer, do it at karaoke shop and then work as a lawyer. So that would be totally, I think I will make a nice life.
So I love that you brought the lawyer example because I think that's probably where I want to dig in is for anybody who's in their career, whether that's, you know, a lawyer, an accountant, any position that somebody's listening to, and maybe they're not finding necessarily the joy in their current work. What is the kind of self-assessment we need to make to see the potential we have in our current career to see if it has the spark of an ikigai?
Yeah. So, and also you can bring your ikigai into the present work. So because ikigai is your attitude. Ikigai is your way you live every day. So if you're living out of joy, then your boring work could be the most amazing work. Well, I was chatting a friend, one of my best friends, yesterday. He started as a janitor. He started as a toilet cleaner. You know, he didn't like studying, so he ended up in washing the toilet. He hated it. But one day, he thought, I just don't like this situation that I don't like my job. What if I like washing the toilet? Then, you know, I don't have to suffer whole time. So he came up with the idea how he can clean well, and it got interesting. So he came up with a special brush. He came up with a special cleaner. He came up with special something, and then he started his own company. And he started teaching people how to wash the toilet. He just expanded his business and he started writing books. Now he's my colleague. He teaches people how to clean your room and clean your life and clean your mind. So he sold about 4 million copies. So he's one of my, you know, best buddies because we often share stages together. And his talk is so dynamic because he started from the toilet cleaner that everybody would hate. But he loves just cleaning the toilet. So whenever we go somewhere, he doesn't come back to the bathroom. And then I wonder, maybe he's having some health issues. And he comes back and said, sorry, it took me a while. You know, I just couldn't stand the bad bathroom. So I had to clean everything. You know, it's not his room. It's not his anything. But he cannot tolerate a terrible bathroom. So he always carries some special brush that he invented and also toothbrush. So whenever he sees some stain, he has this, attitude that, but his love for cleaning is overflowing. So now he's one of the most successful writers, speaker, and a toilet cleaner. So you can make any boring job into profitable occupation.
One of the things you said in this response, which is such an interesting story that for anybody, I think, you know, that gives at least what most people would perceive as a rock bottom job, the potential that still lies there. You spoke about he had an attitude that changed. And I'd be curious to know for anybody who might not see that light at the end of the tunnel with their current job and their attitude is maybe more on the negative side, are there particular questions we can ask or steps we can take that can help us maybe reframe our attitude with our current situation?
Right. Like in North America and Europe, somehow people who make the most money wins. That's a money game we're all kind of like forced to be in. But what if the game is, at the end of the day, how happy I can become? So if you put that category, are you winning the game? I'm not just encouraging you to win any game, but if just for fun of it, if you think the rule is different, at the end of the day, I don't know how much money you made that day, but can you feel peaceful? Can you feel happy with what you've done? Either toilet cleaning or hedge fund manager, whatever that is, can you feel happy? And if you feel happy about the whole day, you win. And if you feel lousy, if you feel terrible, if you feel irritated and frustrated, you lose. If you just put that as one more criteria right next to making money, maybe you see different things. So happy people change your attitude. Instead of just feeling like I'm stuck with this job, you can feel what an honor to be able to clean the toilet. What an honor to do this job that anybody can do. So I often hear people say, Ken, I'm so stuck in my job. Anybody can do this job. So my question to them is, are you giving 100% of what you can offer? And if you are more than 100%, the reality will change. But if you give 80% of your energy to your situation, you cannot get out. So one of my students who was told to put stamps on an envelope for, you know, direct mail these days, I thought people stopped doing it. They are still doing it to sort of educate young people. I mean, they come from like equivalent to like Harvard, you know, university, very top of the top. And many people say, why do I have to do this? You know, I should do something more. But a lot of people came up with the idea, okay, what if, dude, you know, we change the whole thing and then come up with a better way to do it. We can be more efficient. And what if we can imagine a smile for a person who gets this card about new consulting services? And if we just send love into this envelope, it might change. So you can come up with 20, 30 different ideas how to make it more fun, how to make it more time efficient. You are very excited about a very, very simple, tedious job. So if your attitude is like that, your boss will notice you like, okay, I think I should give you a better job or a different job so you can do more. So don't complain about where you are. I always say there are no boring jobs. There are only boring people who are stuck in the job.
So again, I feel like it falls back onto the attitude side, and there's a lot more control we have than we actually imagine. And what about if somebody's kind of in this position saying like, well, I'd be able to do that if only I had X job or I had more money. Like, it always seems like we're chasing something better before making a change in the attitude. And I feel like that's the game that kind of shoots us in the foot.
Yes. You're not given unless you're qualified. So you have to prove yourself at where you are. If all the people around you think you are more worth than the work you do, people will pull you out, either in a way of headhunting or just your boss just notice you, or there will be some offers. You know, I have many of my students who are very successful. They started as a simple job, like waiting tables. And one of my best friend and also a best-selling author, he started as a truck driver, you know. And also one other friend who became the number one bestseller in Japan 2 years ago, he started as, you know, a vendor, you know, the food truck guy, one truck without any engine. So that means he just pulled the food truck by himself when he was 18. So a lot of my friends started from really nothing, but with the attitude, they changed a little bit by a little bit, a little bit. So they got promoted, and then my friend who was starting as a food truck guy, he was headhunted by a CEO of one of the public companies in Japan. And everybody was so surprised, like, why? I mean, he doesn't have any college education even. Why do you just, you know, keep him in like CEO strategy office or something? And he saw something in my friend that one day he'll be somebody, and he became somebody. So if you are full of passion, full of love, full of generosity and kindness, people will notice you.
I want to extend a perspective for someone who is listening to this message, and maybe the self-defeating thought is, well, it's too late for me. I'm already a little older. The kind of mantras that go into the mind is, you can't teach an old dog new tricks. And these are, again, very limiting statements. And I'd be curious to hear from your experience what you've noticed with people that might have more experience under their belt that are being asked to change.
Yes. Like my mentor, when he reached 80, he realized that there's something he hasn't done. So I think it was his 79th birthday I was there. He said, Ken, I'm thinking of starting a publisher. Can you write the first book with me? So I co-authored with him and I said, I'm so busy, I'm booked for like a couple of years. And he said, I might die, you know, if you don't do it with me. So I canceled everything. I wrote my book. That's like 14 years ago. He's now 94. Can you believe that? So he started his publishing company when he was 80, and it's up and running for 14 years, you know. And then myself, I started studying English 7-8 years ago. And I was not confident about sharing this information in English. But now, you know, I make some sexual jokes without me knowing. But besides that, I'm okay. I hope I make myself understood in English. So I started in my 50s. And also, recently, I started studying Chinese. So my dream in my 60s is that I will be able to teach this in Chinese. So I'm an old dog, but I'm still learning new tricks. But very slowly, you know, every day, I try to remember 2 words and I forget 3 words. That's how I feel.
And you know what I find very inspiring is I often look into these articles, whether it's videos or posts that just show a lot of stories of people usually in their 50s that actually find themselves finally tuning into a work that identifies as an ikigai. And I think one of the biographies I've read that I thought was the most interesting was Made in America, the story of Sam Walton behind Walmart, where he was working in various retail and he was doing various stores, but Walmart didn't start till I believe he was in his mid-50s. And it took years before it became the Walmart that we know now. But I find that great because it makes me, even at my age, I like to think I'm still very young, but I'm still trying to figure out like what's going to be the castle that I build. And I want to ask you, when it comes to chasing or looking for your ikigai, it feels like I have to find this ultimate thing that fits perfectly. Is that the right mindset to have as I'm looking for it?
You know, the path to ikigai is not the goal. You know, people think like, if I reach 10 million copies, I will leave my ikigai. No. When I started writing my first sentence, that was the beginning of ikigai. And even before, when I thought I want to become an author, that is already in the process of ikigai. So for those of you who are watching this, you are already in the process of finding your ikigai. In fact, you started years ago without knowing it. You know, Steve Jobs talked about connecting dots. The dots were there. With your permission or without, there are dots. So do you want to connect all the dots or not? That is my question. If you start connecting dots, then you see a good, great picture. So a lot of people figure out at the age 45 or 55 or 65, the right timing is something you have to find. So some people find it very early, like Bill Gates and Steve Jobs. They find their ikigai in their early teens and 20s. That's why they could drop out of college, right? Some people find them in their 20s. Some people find them in their 30s. So like Michael Zuckerberg and those people, they found it when they're in college. For late bloomers, find it in their 40s. But it's okay because there's a perfect timing for everybody. And even before you find it, you're living in ikigai. And after you find it, you are in the ikigai. So in the process of finding your castle, finding your mate, or finishing your castle, all the process is ikigai. You should have fun because otherwise your life would end before you think, oh, this is my ikigai. Oh, I have to die tomorrow, you know?
Well, you know what I find interesting when you quote these stories of, you know, Bill Gates, Steve Jobs, and people that find their ikigai at such a young age, I feel like it has the same Hollywood effect as the way that we perceive love. Almost like how Disney looks at, like, you're supposed to find the one true love, fall madly in love instantly, and then, you know, Cinderella, the shoe fits and everything's beautiful and perfect. And I think the equivalent to that when it comes to living life is we start looking at these stories of people, mad success, 19 years old, and you're like, oh, I'm 22, too late for me. It's like, wait a second. The mass reality is a lot of us are getting to live our own version of ikigai. It's maybe not as sensational as what Hollywood would make a movie about, but I feel like we're all able to choose the kind of story and life that is the beautiful version of our story. It might not go to Hollywood, but that's maybe not a bad thing.
I think I've written a few books on happy compromising. The concept is, can you compromise happily with where you are? Because there's this national bestseller in Japan, a bloom that's when you landed. That means that seed is landed on a certain place, whether you like it or not, but you can start blooming and you can have your own flower. You know, you may not be able to choose the location because that's where you're planted. I call it fate. So the fate puts you into misery, poverty, you know, lots of tough upbringing, but you can have your own flower. It may not be the biggest flower, the tallest flower, or the most gorgeous flower, but having your own flower means everything. So as long as you're happy with where you are and who you are and what you are, you are at the great success. So please don't compare with other people. Some people are born taller, some people are born bigger, more beautiful, more something. They're a better singer, they're a better sports, you know, player or something. But that's who they are. You are probably different. So if you keep comparing yourself with others, that is a shortcut to unhappiness. So find who you are, and if you can find happy compromising, you know, you need to compromise. Don't compare with an incredible you that probably built an incredible castle by the time of your age now. You didn't, because you are who you are. And you wanted to play Nintendo games. You should have worked harder, you know, right? But you had so much fun. So just forgive yourself. Just enjoy, you know, free yourself from guilt, because that's who you are. So instead of just, you know, whipping yourself, like, why didn't you work harder? Why didn't you save money? Why did you spend all the money? You know, why did you waste your time? We can forgive ourselves and just give us permission to be who we are. We are lazy. We cannot do things we decided like 3 days ago, but it's okay. So if you can just embrace for yourself and give yourself a little break, and I think that is the key to happiness.
I feel there is a bit of this rebalancing around this hustle culture that I think was very prominent, at least in the last 10 years, especially through social media. And again, this whole comparison thing, everybody has a lifestyle on Instagram of everything looking perfect. But we were starting to see some of the ripple effects from people that went and really followed the hustle culture, no balance, all work. Have you had stories of people that have went through that belief system and maybe have some lessons to share for those who feel like they should have been hustling harder?
So I give a totally different advice to different people. So for those of you who are too lazy for sharing who you are, for doing things that you're very excited about, but you didn't do it because you're afraid of money and whatnot, you should do more. You should be hustling, because you just pull yourself out of the chair and then you need to do something. And for those of you who are doing too much, you need to relax. So ask yourself, should I do more or should I relax? It's a totally different thing. It's a money, same thing for a spender type. You should start saving. For saver type, you should start spending.
I think we take advice that we see online as a catch-all for everyone. I think we have to be a little more prescriptive.
Right. So for those of you who are watching this and just you're working too hard, you should relax, give yourself a little break. And for those of you who are just, you know, watching this with potato chips in your mouth, you need to do exercise. You need to get out.
Nice. So it'll be a kick on the butt. So we get some people moving if we need to.
Yeah, you know the answer.
Actually, pulling on that, you say you know the answer. I find that oftentimes we're looking externally for answers. We're trying to find answers. We're always looking outward. It's like, okay, maybe there's somebody who's going to tell me what the right thing to do right now so I get closer to my purpose. And I find like what you just said, you know the answer, is not as clear of an advice, or at least we're not sure what to do with that advice because there's a lot of noise. What's our relationship with trusting ourselves into making the right decisions?
That is so true. You know, oftentimes people ask me, Ken, what do you think? I always answer, I don't know. You know better, because I don't know about your life. But it'd be okay if I ask you a few questions. So instead of me teaching something, I always ask good questions, like Jason, you know, like you. So I ask questions like, how do you feel if you start doing more of what you do now? Well, how do you feel if you stop doing what you do now? So they feel certain answers. If your heart is opening up, you should do more. And if your heart is closing down, you stop. So your heart, your body know exactly what to do. Just ask yourself, should I do more? And then your inner voice will say, yeah, I think I'd better get on, you know, my bike, or I need to just start studying something. And then you should. Otherwise, you're going to regret it for not doing it. Like 7 years ago, at least for 3 years, I kept hearing inner voice inside, study English, just start writing in English. And I said, oh, no, I'm okay. I sold enough copies in Japanese. I'm okay with where I am. I'm 100% happy. I don't need to go out. And then one day, I really listened to my heart. Yes, I think it's time. You know, I think I'm enjoying it so much, but it's time for me to start learning English again. I just pick up my old textbook that I used like 30 years ago, 40 years ago. And I started learning one phrase at a time. And I started watching TV, news, and love comedy and all that. So sometimes, you know, my English is a little messed up. But so one by one, I listened to my intuition and synchronicities kept happening. And this is where I am. You know, after two books and probably like 100 million views on YouTube and other things, you know, people talk to me on the street in Paris and Helsinki and in Brisbane because they watch like your show and Louise Howe's and all the other friends' shows. So if I didn't make up my mind and just follow my heart, none of these happened.
I love that you took the time to kind of reflect and the answer became more and more clear. One mistake that I've seen myself make is in the process of saying I should listen to myself is I would have like an impulse idea and then I'd run with it, not really thinking, but just acting. And sometimes it's led me astray. I didn't take the time, as you've mentioned, to study if it's opening the heart, closing the heart. It's almost like when I make these impulsive decisions, right from the moment the thought arises, it's almost from a space of neediness and it's not fully developed into a source of, okay, this is a true action. Is this just a question of giving ourselves more time, or do you have other practices that gets you more clear on differentiating the ones that truly guide you in the right direction versus distractions that is a shiny object?
Right. I have taught a class with my psychic friends how to receive more intuition in like, you know, a few weeks course. To make it very short, there are ways to differentiate impulses, needs, from intuition. For example, feeling the impulse is not intuition. It's your compulsion. It comes from your neediness. It comes from poverty consciousness. So this, I have to do it now, is usually an impulse. It's not intuition. Intuition is very calm. So either you do it, you don't, it's okay. But when you do it, something inside you feels very quiet passion. Whereas impulse is like very hot, you know, now. That's usually takes you to the cliff. And then it's going to be ouch.
See, I've worked in sales and marketing with scarcity too often. It's something that's almost programmed in us, especially with all the media that we get exposed to. It's like, buy now, don't be late, you're going to miss out. And I think these kinds of messages makes us like probably respond to these pulses as more, instinctively? Yeah, almost like it's the reptile part of our brain that gets in control, but we need to sink down.
Yeah, so you have to really know that if you're allowed that type, you should know, you know. In fact, I remember one of the most successful, the line that a Japanese retail shop, you know, it's now a big store. There, it's a big sign in front of a cash register. It said, buy now, regret at home. I thought it's very cute.
Nice.
Isn't that fun?
It is. Well, that's probably the buyer's remorse that happens from this. But again, I think, you know, at least for me, what I've realized is when I said 2 weeks is usually what I do is I write down what the idea is. And usually within 2 weeks, whatever fire of that impulsiveness was will usually simmer down. And then I'll see if it really is something that sticks or not. So I find time is often the best clarity giver for what truly comes from a good intuition.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So a fake passion is something you should watch out. The fake passion is a visible flare, and the true passion is invisible. So usually invisible fire has the highest temperature. You need to watch out because a lot of people are carried away with a big flame. You know, we're like a moth, and usually we get sucked in.
Well, Ken, as always, this has been a lovely conversation. I think we've had a chance to speak about our ikigai, our purpose, understanding how to change our attitudes within whatever it is that we do, because there is gold to be found at whatever situation we are. We've talked about the timing isn't as important as we think. There are different times, different places we find compromise around our situation, realize we can find joy, we can have it aligned with our purpose, we can have our guilty pleasures. And naturally, if we just listen to our intuition and we start actually seeing how it can guide us, not necessarily relying externally for answers, we can itch our way into a life of more alignment and more happiness and more purpose. And I think that's beautiful. And that would be my biggest takeaways from here. And I'd be curious to hear from you, from the conversations we had, if you had a takeaway message for our listeners, how would you sum it up?
That is so beautiful. Thank you. And you are an incredible interviewer. Agree, everyone? You know, thank you so much for inviting me once again. If you're not super bored, I'm happy to come back anytime.
I'm never bored. Ken, it's been an absolute pleasure. Thank you so much for everybody tuning in. Leave a comment. Type in Ikigai into the comments, and we'd love to hear from you. If you are looking to get some more resources on Ikigai, we're going to send you over some more if you leave a comment. And nonetheless, Ken will make sure to send some resources for people to discover more of your work, and it's always a pleasure to have you on the show. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Arigato. Arigato.
Arigato. Thank you for listening to the Jason Mark Campbell Business Podcast. And of course, keep selling with love.
A BetterHelp ad. Lewis Capaldi partnered with BetterHelp to get word out about how important therapy can be.
Or I struggle most weeks to like get up, get myself up and ready and go to therapy or, you know, whatever. Like even like to open the laptop to talk to my therapist sometimes can be really difficult. But I do it because I realise how important it is for me to continue to feel good. Like I felt the best I've felt in a long time through therapy.
Learn more about online therapy at betterhelp.com.